It's going now. I don't know if that was or not. Yes?
I think that rule seems to make sense because then if you even told someone to say, well, someone else hired me to do it, so there'd be a stronger punishment for the actual act than the other, especially when they require witnesses to prove things.
The imprudent, yeah. But they, on the other hand, they say that there are a couple of ways you can be executed for it. First, the king can make his own rules, which are not restricted in this way. So therefore, the king could say, we know you hired the hitman to kill that guy, so I'm going to cut your head off. Furthermore, the court can make special rules in emergency circumstances. And I suspect these are those temporary rules that don't have to be really temporary. And with courts making as an emergency measure, they can execute you even though they can't execute you, so to speak. But in the ordinary case, theoretically, all they do is to lock you up under unpleasant circumstances for a couple of years so that people will not be encouraged to hire other people to kill people. There is then a distinction between killings that are or are not what I would think of as plausibly accidental. So it's again a sort of a manslaughter killing kind, manslaughter murder kind of distinction. And if in deciding whether it fits this category, one question you ask is this a weapon that would normally kill? All right. If you hit somebody with a pillow, you could imagine hitting somebody with a pillow hard and breaking his neck by accident, but that's an accident. Hitting somebody with a sword is not an accident. I suppose it could be if you were fencing or something and slipped, but normally it's not an accident. So one question is, was it the kind of weapon which it would not be unusual to kill someone with, which presumably doesn't have to mean it's intended as a weapon. A hammer might do for that as well. Another question is, if it was, say, a blow of your fist or a hammer, was the strength and the location of the blow such that it would normally kill? And you then get into sort of fairly fine distinctions. If I hit him in the hip, if I tried to hit him in the hip with a blow that would not kill in the hip, but I hit him in the throat instead and killed him, that I think counts as accidental. But if I was trying to hit him in the hip with a blow that might kill in the hip, and I hit him in the throat instead and killed him, that's not accidental. So that kind of distinction. Similarly, if I push him off a roof, if the roof is, if the fall is short enough so that you wouldn't expect somebody to be killed by that fall, then it counts, then the fact that he dies counts as accidental, presumably I was intending to do something to him, whereas if it's high enough so that you would expect him, then it does not count as accidental. And those are one category of not, there's a, here. So, one category is not capital, plausibly accidental. I'm writing this down because this stuff gets a little bit complicated and it may be easier to keep track of this way about what happened in each case. And the other is not capital, inadequate witnesses. All right? So what you actually did was to take a sword and cut his head off. But you carelessly did not provide yourself with two witnesses who had told you in advance cutting people's head off is a capital offense, and so don't do it. And so, since that theoretically is what the law requires, theoretically they can't execute you, even though it was by no means an accident. All right, so we've got those two categories of not capital. And the second one is, for example, if you did have two witnesses, and both of them warned you not to do it, but one of them did you warned you at noon and one at 2 o'clock, that doesn't do it. They got to do it together. They got to, I'm not sure if they've got to do it, see each other or simultaneously, but somehow sequential witnesses don't count. However, that's all right, because when we know you did it, but we only have sequential witnesses or some other lack of all the details, we can't cut your head off, but we can lock you up, feed you bread and water until your stomach shrinks, then feed you barley so your stomach splits, and that takes care of that. And it's a little hard to tell just how literally he means this as a way of executing people slowly, but it certainly is what it sounds like. On the other hand, he seems to be saying that for other crimes which are serious, non-capital, and you don't have adequate witnesses, you don't punish them that way. Those ones you actually do get free, if I understand him correctly. In any case, you've killed somebody in some one of these ways. And what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to go to a city of refuge. I should say, all of this is one of the reasons why I believe... All right, we missed a chunk of the class due to a low battery in my recorder. With luck, we're in business now. All right, so for damages, suppose that I damage a piece of your property. How might we figure out what I owe you for that particular damage short of destruction? What? Suppose it can't be repaired. What would be the other obvious thing? Alternative. Change in market value. Well, you and I may not be used to people having market values, but then we live in a rather unusual society in that respect. And in ancient Israel, they have slaves. And slaves have market value, and slaves are people, right? Just like you and me. So the rule in theory, at least if Maimonides is to be believed, is that you say, if I were a slave in the marketplace, how much less would I be worth with one eye instead of two? And that's the damage payment for putting out an eye. Which is sort of screwy, but it's sort of neat at the same time that you're able to think of people in those terms. Now that damage requires permanent injury. So for damages, if I am hurt but then fully recover, you don't owe anything for damages. Pain, interestingly enough, is what an economist would call revealed preference. Pain, the question is, what payment would you take to endure this pain? And to a lot of moderns, this seems rather unjust, because the amount you would have to pay Bill Gates to agree to have his finger crushed between, you know, in a door and some pain for a while is probably quite a lot more than the amount you would have to pay a random person. That doesn't seem to bother my mind. At least he explicitly says that one of the things that will affect the money value of the pain is how wealthy the victim is, and also how sensitive he is, you know, how much pain bothers him. So that gives you a basis for pain. Medical treatment, interestingly enough, they make a fairly modern distinction. How do we decide you've been injured? What are the alternative ways in which we might set how much I owe you since it was my fault for your medical treatment? What are the two? Of course, I could be idleness as well, but let me take medical treatment. What are the two obvious approaches? As in many other cases. What might we do? The court has just judged, there you are, you've just been carried off home, and they're about to call a physician. So, how do we decide how much I owe you? Medical expenses calculated how? When? When do we do the calculation? Not when did the... At the time of judgment, which is before we know what the medical expenses are. So, one possible answer... and an answer which I think you sometimes get in modern systems, is the court estimates what the medical expenses are going to be, and I then owe you that amount of damage. The other obvious alternative is that we wait, and I got to pay your doctor's bills. What's the argument in favor of each of those? Why might it make more sense to have it a fixed payment initially? Yep. That's one reason. Well, is there another reason?
Person might die or go insolvent.
You mean the injurer might be insolvent initially too. In fact, you might say he's more likely to be insolvent if you insist on his paying the whole sum up front than if he's paying it week by week. Huh. None of you are thinking like economists. If we say I'm going to pay your medical expenses, well, you know, you don't really want to have a room in the hospital you share with somebody else when you can have a single room. And you don't really want the hospital in your town when there's a much more luxurious and pleasant or a slightly better hospital in the next city. And, you know, once they send you home, you really ought to see the doctor every day or two just to make sure. That is to say, what the expenses are, to some extent, is going to depend on choices made by the patient. And if you know that whatever you do, someone else is going to pay for it, you have no incentive to keep down the costs. This, of course, is an argument that shows up in the whole medical health insurance issue, that one disadvantage of insuring for things is that the patient has less of an incentive to try to keep costs down. On the other hand, there's the obvious problem that if you make it a fixed payment at the beginning. One problem, of course, is that it might turn out to be wrong just because of random chance, and then somebody either gets a windfall if he gets well in a couple of days and has been paid for a month, or is in real trouble if he's been paid for a month and takes 3 months. But the other problem is the court doesn't have the information that, you know, the court doesn't have a very clear idea at the time how long it'll take, and therefore, so you really have arguments for both. And Maimonides, interestingly enough, says that the rule is that you estimate the amount in advance and the tortfeasor pays it. But that this rule is put in for the benefit of the tortfeasor, and therefore he has the option, if he prefers, of saying, no, I'll pay your bills as they come in. So presumably if he thinks the court's going to estimate it high, and is willing to accept the risk that you'll be extravagant with his money, he can do it that way. What's the other way you can imagine doing it, which would take care of the extravagant with his money, but might have other problems? What are you going to do? You're the tortfeasor. And the court says, it's going to cost 400 zuds. And you say, maybe I better pay it week by week. And the patient says, well, you may if you like, but you know, I'm hiring Maimonides. He's the best doctor in Egypt. And he costs 100 zuds a week. So what might you as the tortfeasor suggest instead? That's one possibility. How about my cousin is a physician? He's a really good physician. I'll pay his bills and he'll take care of it. All right. Maimonides does not approve of this solution. All right. It makes a certain kind of sense. I did the damage, I'll fix it. But given how ambiguous fixing the damage is for human injuries, it's not entirely clear you want the guy who pays for it to control the quality any more than you want the guy who doesn't pay for it. Right, it's a problem in either direction. If we say that the patient decides on the treatment and the tortfeasor pays whatever it costs, then the patient has an incentive to be extravagant. But if you say the tortfeasor both pays for it and decides on the treatment and doesn't get the benefit of the treatment, then he has an incentive to be insufficiently extravagant and to hire a fourth-rate doctor when a second-rate doctor would be a better decision. Right. So I think that covers what we're doing this time. Just sort of keep looking over the stuff. Read what you read again if you feel like it, or read other stuff if you want. I was planning to spend Thursday doing more of what we've been doing, basically discussing the law. Hopefully by Thursday I will have finished writing up my summary, probably an outline of the Irish law stuff, and I'll put that book on reserve in the library so that by next Tuesday you can have read a couple of chapters of that book and whatever by that time I've written and put up about it. All right? Everybody happy? Goodbye.